But our text starts off by telling us that large crowds were following Jesus, going along with him. And the reason that this is an important little factoid to hold on to is because everything that Jesus says in this passage is based with this audience of the crowds in his mind. That's who he's talking to. He's not talking to his disciples. He's talking to everybody else. Like sheep without a shepherd, these were the folks who were following the latest movement at the moment that he was there. They wanted to be part of something bigger than themselves. They probably followed him for all kinds of reasons that we'll never be completely aware of. He was healing folks and feeding people. Maybe he'd heal and feed them. He was teaching amazing things to people. Maybe he would teach them something amazing. He was, in his day and age, a rock star, if you will. Anybody who could attract 5,000 people on a side hill in Galilee as an itinerant rabbi is huge in his day and age. He was challenging conventional religious wisdom, and he was challenging conventional political authority. Maybe he would simply challenge the whole empire and bring it to its knees, people might have been thinking. All kinds of reasons that people would have turned out to see him. But whatever the reason they were following him, he, meaning Jesus, didn't want them to follow him anymore. So Luke puts it into stark relief. Jesus turns on the crowds, it says. He doesn't just look at them. He turns on them in a very deliberate move, and he says to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and his mother and his wife and his children, his brothers and his sisters, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. His message is completely uncompromising. You are not able, he says, to be my disciple if you place anything, including your most cherished relationships, your own life, all of your property, ahead of following me. At this point, I just want to be honest with you and say, see you later. Seriously. That's what I would respond to. And if you didn't respond that way, I would think there was something seriously wrong with you. It's not the only time that he has said something like this either, as at least anti-family, we could say. He said in Luke's gospel in chapter 12, three chapters before this, that he came to cast fire upon the earth to bring division to the houses, to set father against son, mother against daughter, and mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and so on and so forth. So it wouldn't surprise us, it shouldn't anyway, that he tells us that we should hate our families. But it should concern us. We should be asking why. Why would somebody who has such a popular message, who has so much power to heal and transform, why would this person personally subvert all of that to push it all away so that literally nobody wants to follow him anymore? Why? That's the question that's been bothering me, pondering. He's not advocating that we take some kind of emotional stance of hatred, meaning that I'm going to literally hate the way you know and I know what hate feels like. No, he's saying, count the cost of what it's going to be to follow me in terms of your honor. This is a society that lives by honor and shame. And he's saying that if you don't factor in what this will do to your family by following in my footsteps, you're a fool. People are going to get killed following this way that I'm advocating. And he knows it because that's what he's facing as he goes off to Jerusalem. And the word that he uses here for hate is misio, which has been translated as hate, which I think is good in the sense that it gets across that uncompromising nature that Jesus is laying down. But it's laden in our context, in the English context, with all kinds of emotional content. Like, you know, hating is an emotion. But in the ancient world, it wasn't about hating your family in terms of emotional. It was about injuring them. It was about doing something that disgraced them, that damaged the family's name and identity in the community. In essence, this is what the younger and the older brother in the story of the prodigal do to the father. They both disgrace and shame dad, right? And that's what's so amazing about that story is that he allows that shame to go on to him and takes it all upon himself and still reaches out to love the younger and the older son. It's about dishonoring your family, really, is a better way to translate it. Those of you who follow me will be dishonoring your fathers. You'll be dishonoring your mothers. You'll be dishonoring your whole family. You'll bring shame upon them. And this would have been a real concern, mind you, to Luke's community at the turn of the first century when persecutions are beginning to pick up throughout the Roman Empire, when Nero is burning things down in Rome and blaming it on the Christians and so forth. Division within families was commonplace at that point in terms of the followers of Jesus. And they were just upsetting families. People were standing in communities and wondering what next was going to befall them. And a scholar by the name of Tannehill goes way back, this scholar, cites letters that he's discovered from the first century in which Roman families complain that their sons or their daughters have run off and joined a cult called the People of the Way, which is what the Christians were first called, People of the Way. Now, as if that weren't enough, right? If that wasn't enough, Jesus follows up that statement with another whopper. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Which is another way of stating the obvious. Anyone who follows Jesus must live with the expectation that doing so could lead to the same fate that Jesus will face in Jerusalem. In other words, if you do this, you're facing public execution in the most ridiculing, shameful way possible. You'll be seen and labeled as a traitor by the empire. They'll nail you on a cross along the Appian Way and all those roads leaning in and out of Rome so everybody can look at you and go, that's what happens to a disgraced person in the empire. Somebody who thought they could possibly overthrow this huge, huge conglomerate of power. And so he says then the obvious wisdom saying, for which of you wanting to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, right? To see if you have enough to complete the task. Or what king going out to encounter another king in war does not sit down and deliberate with themselves, if I can win and I only have half the troops necessary and the other king has a full complement, a division, maybe I ought to sue for peace. Maybe I ought to not fight this battle and get slaughtered. So these two parables suggest to us the importance of making a reasonable assessment of success or failure before embarking on a task of any kind, that wisdom saying does. It's something to bear in mind when it comes to the wars that this country is fighting today, right? The endless wars that we don't seem to be able to get out of, that are protracted, that we're not going to win, that will go on and on and on and on ad nauseum. It's something to bear in mind when we do things that are foolish like that. Because if you don't succeed, ultimately, you bring ridicule and shame upon yourselves and your community and your nation, which is what's happening for us. Not to mention death and destruction. So our text concludes with a summary statement. So therefore, whoever does not give up or renounce everything, you cannot be my disciple. That's the third time that he has said, you cannot be my disciple in this text. And that's something to take note of. I mean, when Jesus stresses something three times in a single parable, pay attention. First, anyone who puts family before Jesus is not able to be my disciple. Second, anyone who does not bear his cross is not able to be my disciple. And last, anybody who doesn't forsake, give up everything that he has, including their most precious things, religion, family, possessions, is not able to be my disciple. Thus, we can assume that Jesus is laying down in no uncertain terms what it means to follow him. No, thank you. Thank you. Now, if you want to get off this Christian bus, boy, I completely understand, because I would. Jesus is challenging everything that is near and dear to us. And in so doing, he is winnowing out the followers from the disciples. He's winnowing away all the people that have gathered around him. And the question then comes back to why? Why? And there's absolutely no consensus by scholars on this question. Nobody, it seems to me, has got the right or the definitive or the last possible answer. It's wide open, which I think is what Luke intends for it to be. I think this parable is going to be something that each and every one of us who claims to be Christian ultimately has to answer for ourselves. It's not like I'm going to be able to tell you, here is the nice little answer, do this, everything will be fine with Jesus. No, I don't know ultimately what the right answer is here. Maybe Jesus thinks that he has too many people who are hanging around for the wrong reasons, right? Like free food, or in the hopes that somebody will get another miracle. But I think that this is the reason for me that makes sense. He has too many people who have absolutely no idea what going to Jerusalem means for him, or what it will mean for them if they continue just to lollygag along this parade route without counting the costs. So like Gideon, another great leader in the Old Testament, who fought the Midianites and Judges, if you want to look this story up, it's in Judges 6 through 8. Jesus looks out at this huge crowd that's been following him now and realizes that his army is in fact too large to do battle with the enemy. It's too big, got too many troops. And like Gideon, who kept winnowing away at his 32,000 man force, so Jesus is winnowing away at his forces. Thus, we can assume with all of this that Jesus is laying down in no uncertain terms what it means to follow and why he doesn't necessarily want us to follow him at this moment. People must have thought that Gideon was crazy for wanting to eliminate 31,700 willing troops to get down to 300. He wanted to fight the Midianites with only 300 troops, and he did, and he defeated them with 300 troops. It must have seemed like a nuts thing from any strategic standpoint to do this. And yet, that's what Gideon does. Likewise, people must have thought Jesus nuts for winnowing down his troops as he approaches Jerusalem, the center of religious and political power in this area of the kingdom. But in this case, Jesus isn't winnowing down to just 300 troops. He's winnowing it all the way down to one troop. Jesus alone and by himself will take on the powers and the principalities all by him lonesome in Jerusalem. Like a medic, if you've ever seen the Band of Brothers movie, there's a scene in Bastogne, in the Battle of Bastogne, where the Americans are besieged by German troops that just outnumber them. They're completely surrounded in this little tiny town, middle of winter. Allies can't get in supplies, can't get in ammo because of the overhanging clouds and everything. And these Americans are cut off from everything that's hope-filled that would get them out of this alive. It looks impossible for them to ever get out of this alive. And there's this one scene in which the Nazis are shelling the interior area of Bastogne where the Americans are, and you see trees exploding everywhere, just hell breaking loose on the battlefield. And you see a medic run out into the midst of this carnage without a weapon on, with his little red crossed medic bag on his shoulder, throw himself over this soldier who's been shot and is bleeding out to protect his body with his body, while bullets and machine gun fire and mortars are flying all around with no regard whatsoever for his own safety. This medic does this, and he uses his own body to shield this wounded soldier, just as Jesus will use his own body to shield those of us and those even not of us who are willing to follow in his way, truth, and life. In other words, Jesus acts like the medic on the battlefield. He's the guy that's willing to lay down every concern for self in order to save somebody else. Greater love has this, that you lay down your life for a fellow human being, Jesus says. That's what he's doing. And when you think about it, that's exactly what heroes do, true heroes. I mean, we use the word hero for all kinds of things, like sports heroes and stuff. No. Heroes are people who are willing to sacrifice their very lives. That's a true hero. A hero risks his or her life for other people without thought of their own. And in this way, Jesus models what a true hero and a real leader does on behalf of his troops. He is the first to face the winnowing fire. Not his troops, he is. And only after he has conquered that machine gun nest called Calvary and come to defeat its power of holding us in bondage to death forever will he invite us to join in the battle. After the initial battle has been won, and then the floodgates open up. Then he'll say, come on through. And by using this tough language in Luke's gospel, he, in essence, to me, is saying, the path I have chosen is for me alone to travel at this time. It's not for you to travel at this time. Not the one I'm on, anyway. Eventually, you will follow. Yes, each one of you. And eventually, you will have a cross that you have to deal with. It will come to you. Life will give it to you. I guarantee it. But it will come only after I have defeated the foe, which is death, ultimately. After I have secured the victory, then you can come and you can help pick up your own cross and follow after me to make sure this victory lasts and continues to spread down through generations. So maybe, just maybe, these really harsh words of Jesus about cross-bearing are our call as his followers today to ask this question: what does it mean for me today in my own life to pick up my cross? What is my cross exactly, right? What is your cross exactly today that you have to carry in your own life to pick up and follow after Christ? What is it that's being asked to be given up in order that you might have more abundance of life? Do I cling to family for all my identity at all costs, for example? Is that the only way I know that I'm of value because of my family name? Well, maybe you want to be a little freer than that, Jesus says. Or maybe I cling to my possessions for a sense of self-worth and security, right? That's a normal thing. I want to secure my future. I want to know things are going to be okay. Who else will do it if I don't? Maybe Jesus is saying, look, if you cling that closely to that, maybe you need to give that up too. Right? And anything that gets in the way of this abundance of life that God wants to have and give you, you're going to have to give up, Jesus says, if you want the abundance of life. If you don't want it, you don't have to give it up. Maybe that's what it's about. Do I put religious doctrine, for example, ahead of the needs of human beings that are right in my path? Well, you know, like the guy, the Good Samaritan, the Levite, and the priest who go by, you know, they're looking through their rule book as to what to do in this situation. There's a guy here who's injured on the side of the road, but, you know, if he's not clean, then I'm going to have to ritually clean myself and do all these other things before I continue on my day's journey. So I'm going to go through and figure out what is the appropriate thing to do. Jesus says that's nonsense. Somebody's bleeding, help them. End of story. Right? Are we willing to do that? And I don't know the correct answer, by the way, to all of these questions I'm asking. I really don't. To be honest, I think I'm going to wrestle with these hard sayings of Jesus for the rest of my life. And I'm going to have to make peace with the fact that I might not be able to live up to everything that Jesus expects out of me. And that's where grace comes in now. Because I know Jesus is winnowing away people in this passage. I know that's his intent. It strikes me as nothing else makes any sense. So in a certain sense, I take some comfort that he's saying to me, Stephen, not now, but it will come someday. And that's the part. That's the part. So like Jesus, I think I'm going to struggle with this kind of mission that God's called me on, trying to discover what it is in the first place that he's called me to carry and what it means to do this. And the other is, I'm going to also be praying constantly, like Jesus, if it's possible, take this cup from me. Really, I don't want to suffer, but not my will. Your will be done. And that's the essence of giving up to God, right? I don't want this, but it's not about what I want. It's about your will. Amen.